This week on Excelsior Journeys, it is part 4 of our Transformers the Movie 35th Anniversary Celebration. I not only have Clint Dilley here to talk about Five Faces of Darkness and everything that happened immediately after the movie, but I also have FJ DeSanto, the current torchbearer of the Transformers franchise, to talk to you about the War for Cybertron trilogy. He's got a lot to say about it. JLD, do the honors.
Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
Welcome to this very special Excelsior Journeys miniseries celebrating the 35th anniversary of Transformers the Movie. Every Tuesday in August, you will hear from various cast and crew members and other special guests discussing the development, the voices, the music, the aftermath, and the film's legacy. So get ready to go beyond good, beyond evil, beyond your wildest imagination. Till all are one and ever upward. Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys. This is George Soroy. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for tuning in for over 100 episodes. So thrilled with how everything's come along, especially this five-part miniseries of the 35th anniversary celebration of Transformers the Movie. If you've listened to parts 1, 2, and 3, thank you so much for doing so. Any sort of feedback from you is always appreciated. If you enjoy these sorts of themes, if you want me to continue on with those, please let me know. I am really at your beck and call, listeners. And here we are in part 4. Now, we have spoken about the development of the movie. We have spoken about the voices that brought those characters to life. We have spoken about the music behind every single scene in that movie. But what comes after? Now, we know, and you'll be hearing a little bit from Flint Dilley later on in this episode about the immediate future right after the movie with the Five Faces of Darkness sequel miniseries that started up season 3 of Transformers Generation 1 and a little bit beyond that. But Transformers obviously did not end with the 3-part miniseries, The Rebirth, in 1987. It has gone on in many different directions. And the latest one really has me, really had me excited as soon as I started watching it on Netflix. And granted, I only got to watch a couple of episodes of Siege, which is part 1 of the Transformers War for Cybertron trilogy. Only got to watch a couple of episodes before my Netflix account. We decided to cut it short for a little while. But this month, we got back into it, and I immediately went right back in, watched Siege from the very beginning, and was so taken with that, I started watching Earthrise immediately. And as we are recording this, just a few hours ago, I finished watching Kingdom, and it made me so grateful that the showrunner of the War for Cybertron trilogy, FJ DeSanto, has agreed to come on and talk about being the current torchbearer of this franchise. And it is my pleasure to introduce to you writer-producer FJ DeSanto. FJ, how are you, sir?
Oh my God, no pressure with the torchbearer line. Oh my God.
Well, you know how it is. Like, there's always some sort of iteration of Transformers. And you know, you're not going to be the last one, but you are the latest one. So yeah,
I'm the fortunate one.
Yes.
To be honest, to be very lucky to be involved with this franchise.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit before we go back to the very beginning of how you got into Transformers in the first place. Tell us a little bit about Kingdom, the miniseries that wraps up this whole trilogy.
So you want me to start with Kingdom? Kingdom, which is the last part, is the first time we're seeing the Beast Wars characters on screen all together like this in like 25 years. And it was always designed to sort of coincide with the 25th anniversary, and it's been something I've had to shut my mouth about for about 3.5 years.
Nice.
And it's also the most daunting of the 3 chapters we've done because of the responsibility of reintroducing those characters and doing them in a way where they interact with the so significantly with the G1 characters. Mm-hmm. So that was always the sort of most daunting challenge of the project, to be honest with you. The scariest thing. That was the one, like, even in the office, like, all the artwork was hidden behind a door and all that stuff, because we didn't want people coming in and being like, oh shit, you're going to be doing these characters and all this stuff. But yeah, that's what Kingdom is. The Kingdom represented a challenge in which we had to tie up the whole War for Cybertron story, mm-hmm. which is naturally, because of the nature of the first two chapters, G1 centric.
Yeah.
And find a way to incorporate the Beast Wars characters into that particular story while wrapping the whole thing up, which was not easy. Thanks to very, very talented writers and very talented animators and directors and things like that, we were able to pull it off.
Yeah, I was really, really taken by it. And actually, the funny thing was that I spent a lot of time on watching Earthrise, wondering when they were going to arrive on Earth and have to be reformatted in the way so that they are following the look of the line of the Earthrise line that Hasbro released. Now, did they come to you and say that they were going to take their line in their own direction and just kind of let you everything?
No, what happened was, now that the show's done, I can be a little more outgoing or sort of more forthcoming in sort of the behind the scenes stuff of it all.
Nice.
Is the honest to God truth is we knew that the Earth modes were going to be in there.
Yeah.
But what we couldn't figure out in 6 episodes was a story reason on how the G1 characters would get their Earth modes.
Yeah.
Because we couldn't have them go to 1984 Earth and then go to prehistoric Earth and all this stuff in 6 episodes when, like I just said earlier, I have to wrap the main story up.
Yeah.
While introducing these Beast Wars characters. And what I don't want to do is take any time away from the Beast Wars characters. And right. Hasbro, to their credit, understood this. Mm-hmm. We did play with an idea that unfortunately got cut of, I can spoil Kingdom a little bit on here, but in the first episode after the crash, Optimus is damaged.
Yeah.
And eventually there's like a medical bay scene and all that stuff. There was a bit where we played with the idea of the Beast Wars characters having the technology to sort of help him and inadvertently upgrade him because they would have his future specs.
Oh, nice. Right?
But we didn't do it.
But, I like
but
that.
If you look close enough, there is a giant Easter egg on a computer screen that actually says 1984 and shows these little snippets of alternate Transformers history.
Cool.
To make it easier for people is polygon.com, the website. Mm-hmm. Actually did an article where they figured all that out. And I was shocked how quickly they figured it all out.
Wow.
So that's worth checking out. But Hasbro, to their credit, because I think we used so many of the characters from the toy line, mm-hmm. Especially in Siege, that when we were sort of 3 seasons into it, they weren't going to give us a hard time, especially when we couldn't figure out a genuinely compelling story reason for the Earth modes.
Right. Right,
which I'm sure there are fans who are listening to this be like, hate me for it, because I've gotten the usual comments like, wow, no Earth modes. What is this all about? But as loyal as we try to be with the toys, there's certain instances where we just couldn't.
Yeah, because at the same time, you have to be not a slave to, but like just you have to acknowledge the amount of space that you have to work with. And right. there really is, just like you said, having to go, taking the time like to leave Cybertron, then traveling to Earth, crashing on Earth, getting reformatted on Earth, continuing everything, and then somehow getting some sort of time travel incident that puts them all the way back at the beginning. Like, you get whiplash by doing
and then
that.
You've confused the audience and you've sort of lost them. That's the honest to God truth. It just, believe me when I tell you, even from the earliest stages of development, mm-hmm. we were trying to figure out ways around that. I mean, even Hasbro was presenting ideas and it was just like, I'm like, guys, I want to help you, but it can't work. That's the problem.
Right.
And that's the honest to God truth.
Yeah. And we'll delve into this a little bit more, but let's go back to the very beginning, because from just the brief amount of time that I've known you, having seen Siege, Earthrise, and Kingdom and loving them so much, spoiler alert, I love them all, and I am
that helps the conversation.
I'm really taken with that sort of with the way that the characters were. That's the thing that really that really grabbed me. I love the fact that there were the way that the factions were, there were strategies against each other, and it wasn't a typical, it wasn't like the same old episodes that we knew from growing up. We didn't know, like, not like, so that way it's not specific to each episode, is just like a different plan the Megatron has, an end game in his mind. And it's not all laid out the way that it was at the beginning. It's not Megatron saying in More Than Meets the Eye episode one, we shall return home with the power to make the ultimate weapon and conquer the universe. Like, there it is right there, episode one. This is not something you can just put on passively and just go off and do something else. You have to be fully invested in what's going on. And I appreciate that as a fan. So I can assume with 99% certainty that you were a fan growing up with this franchise, correct?
Yeah, but strictly G1, I'm being candid, being nice, is that I was lucky to be the right age, a little kid, when Transformers first arrived in the world.
Yeah, same here.
So I had the advantage of being able to go to see the 86 movie and really get the early toys. And also sort of coincided with a lifelong interest in anime and manga and stuff like that. Its roots in Japan. In particular, I had a sort of romantic love of the post G1 Japanese, well, they're still considered G1, but the Japanese shows.
Oh yeah, the Headmasters
and Victory and all that stuff. Like I sort of had a very romantic view of like getting bootleg VHS tapes of that as a kid. You know what I mean? Yeah, certain things like that become part of your vernacular. Like the funny thing is, when I was first brought into Transformers, I was a fan, but I wasn't like an uber nutso fan, right? And I was actually brought in initially sort of be the guy in the room who understood it, but could balance all the other writers out. This is when we did Power of the Primes. Mm-hmm. And subsequently, after this one, I had to really educate myself on Beast Wars. Because by the time they do Beast Wars, I was like off at school and stuff like that. And like, luckily, younger people on the show, like my supervising producer and one of our writers, May Cat, were the right age where it was there. Entry point into Transformers.
Yeah.
So I think that's really important when you're crafting these shows, is how do you do these things in a way where you honor what's come before, you honor the fan base the best you can, but also make it appealing. Because look, there is a business side to it, and there is a responsibility of creating a show that's an open door to anybody who wants to jump on board and watch it. You know, like, my hope with this one was that if it was a young person or kid or anybody, their first time seeing Transformers, they could get invested that way and want to explore the rest of the franchise, no matter what it was. So, and sort of to get that feeling that I had when it first came out, and I was obsessed with, you know, Soundwave and different characters, and they were doing all this crazy stuff, and it was just great.
So I have to ask, as from one fan to another, because I discovered the franchise when I was 8 years old, and they were out. Season one was every Sunday morning in Poughkeepsie, New York, WPIX 11. And then the next season, it was 5 days a week in the afternoons after school. So I saw the movie when I was 10. And so having just celebrated my 45th birthday, this has been with me. This whole franchise has been with me a lot longer than almost anything else in my life, any other real franchise. So as a fan, speaking from one fan to another, what was your first Transformer? Which one did you wind up owning first?
Oh, it was definitely Soundwave.
Nice. He was my third. I got him from Kmart. I remember that. And
I don't remember where I got it, but the other thing was like, and the advantage of growing up in New York, and we had comic stores and toy stores in Japanese communities, I would get a lot of like weird Japanese imports and stuff like that.
Oh, cool.
Stuff that's long lost or whatever. But like I said, I had a romantic view of it. Especially the 86 movie, which, because it was clearly animated differently, and that anime style that I just fell in love with around that time, because I was into like Macross and Gatchaman and Yamato. That was sort of my whole thing. Mm-hmm. So I remember Soundwave, but then I have all the basic guys, Optimus, Megatron. And mm-hmm. I'm trying to think what else. They're all at my dad's house somewhere.
Oh, nice.
Because I didn't throw anything out.
Wow.
But I was really into the show, and I was really into stuff, especially weirdly, like there's a lot of corny stuff in the 86 movie. I'm going to sound mm-hmm. like I'm talking shit about it, but I'm not.
Right.
But then there's stuff like Unicron and Galvatron, and I was obsessed with that kind of stuff. Like
yeah.
that. Sort of those weird, not weird, but sort of really interesting sci-fi tropes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, that I really found fascinating.
Yeah. If I would ever show any, this movie to a non-fan, I would basically just start off with Prime saying Megatron must be stopped no matter the cost. And I would end it with Galvatron saying, would anyone else attempt to fill his shoes? Because that 15-minute block of time is perfection. Like everything yeah. and that everything there worked so well, and nothing to say nothing about the rest of the movie. I adored the whole movie. It's obvious considering what I'm doing with this whole celebration.
It's amazing.
But it's something really, really special about that movie and that particular spot. Just like you said, it's very sci-fi oriented, especially with the reformatting of Megatron and Galvatron. And you know, everything there just worked. It worked in a way that I just knew, like as a kid, and you can tell from the attack on the shuttle that this is going to be very different than anything we've seen the first two seasons.
Yeah. And we sort of, I mean, you've seen Kingdom now, like there's so many homages to that in
yeah.
Kingdom yeah. in particular with Galvatron and
I loved how Galvatron got brought into this. I thought that was magnificent. Like the way that was done.
We played around with a lot of different ways to how to do that.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Like how to make, like, we always knew Galvatron was going to be in it.
Yeah.
Cause they told us like, hey, there's going to be a Galvatron. And the beauty of the toy people is they don't have to explain why.
Yeah.
You know, like we're going to do Galvatron in Kingdom. Okay. Why?
Figure it out.
Yeah. We want to do a Galvatron toy. And it's like, okay. So we had a really good plan. The writers did a great job sort of introducing him in Earthrise and sort of setting it up. And I had sort of an obsession with Nemesis Prime, like how to make him mean something, et cetera. And
yeah,
you know, like I even have like the Japanese Siege Nemesis Prime, which I bought for way too much money. But at the time, no one knew Nemesis was going to be in the show.
Right.
And I was like, oh, this is cool. I'm going to have it. I'm staring at it right now. But like just a little tidbit is, a sort of a nod to G1 and the 86 movie is Nemesis can fly.
Oh,
you know, like, we see Nemesis like when he jumps up in the air.
Yeah.
And he attacks Prime. That was sort of a mini homage to that era where they all flew around and stuff like that. We made a decision early on that they wouldn't fly.
Right.
Cause that opens just too many cans of worms, but
yeah,
you know, the idea that like a future Nemesis Prime could figure something like that out.
Oh yeah,
there's a little wink nod to the old days,
to the More Than Meets the Eye miniseries when they would be able to fly, just like float in the air while they're shooting. So
yeah.
Oh, that's great. I didn't even notice that, but you know, that's fabulous. So all the more reason to go back and rewatch these shows. I'm all for it, and I was really taken by the way that certain elements were introduced. That really, as a fan, just had me really kind of sitting up and take notice, especially showing the Quintesson ship before we got to see Decius. And just that whole sequence, like as soon as I saw that ship, I was like, oh, Quintessons. So yeah, like this, that
was our director came up with that. We just had, I think in the scripts, it was, and somebody on the team, if they ever listen to this, will tell me if I'm wrong. But the scripts just had sort of listed as Decius's headquarters or base or whatever the hell, fortress or whatever. And the director showed us concept art of sort of an upside down Quintesson spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like that, the idea was like he was exiled to this part of Char.
Yeah.
And, but it was like a little wink nod to the 86 movie. The director, a guy named Kame-san, and there's another guy whose name I can't recall, who's the guy who does all the transformations and stuff like that in animation.
Yeah, which are beautiful, by the way. Like,
yeah, I was, they're toy accurate. I don't know if
yeah.
Well, most of them are.
Yeah.
They worked on the old series. They worked on the 86 movie.
Oh, nice.
So like in a very, very, like in their very early days of animation as designers or artists or whatever.
Yeah.
So the advantage of that is you sort of have a pedigree for the show
mm-hmm.
on both sort of sides of it, meaning the US side and the Japan side, who have an understanding and love for it. But a lot of that has to do, the writers in particular are all fans.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain knowledge base in the fandom that comes with that.
Yeah.
But also the team in Japan, the animators and stuff like that, they have genuine love for it. And then the other thing of that is the animation studio Polygon Pictures in Japan, they've worked on multiple Transformers series. So you have people there who understand how these shows operate and what is expected from them.
Right. Right. And did Hasbro give any sort of any, did they have any issues with characters that did not stay alive for very long?
We had a list from them.
Yeah.
So we had sort of a, like at the time, there was a very large list of characters for all three shows. And by the way, that doesn't mean they all ended up as toys or not. Like it was really early on, like
right.
things evolved and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a certain list of, especially starting with Siege, like these characters can stay on Cybertron. These characters have to go on the arc for Earthrise. Right?
Oh, okay.
And then there was a sort of list of you can kill this character, that character, et cetera. I don't even remember it.
Oh, wow.
To be honest with you, we just sort of went and did it. And then there were characters like who weren't even originally supposed to be in the toy line at all, like mm-hmm. Alita or Alpha, like Alpha Trion and all this stuff that we just ended up using because they made more sense for the story.
Right, right. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this. Like I'm sure like all, you know, other fans were probably up in arms about this, but I was able to accept the fact early on, right, about the very beginning, that the voices I knew growing up and everything would not be associated with this. So I just went with how they, not even how they gave their interpretation, but how they applied their voice to each character, considering the situations. And I was still really taken by it. I think that the acting in this across the board, I thought was very, very good.
Thanks.
And especially the scene between Optimus and Megatron, the how did we get to this? I am a sucker for those kinds of scenes. I am an absolute sucker. Like I'm sure that I know that Michael Mann didn't exactly think of me when he came up with the coffee shop scene with Pacino and De Niro in Heat, but like any time when you have your main characters, your main protagonist, your antagonist, when they're sitting down somewhere, like there is a, when it's done right, there is a really good aura about that scene. And I felt
Which scene? The one in the first one or the second one?
Second one.
When they're Earthrise. In the space station and all that stuff.
Yeah, and Optimus said basically like uncovered Megatron when he was when he was covered by the rubble. I must have rewound that scene like about two or three times. Just like I need to like really get into this, especially because it's inspiring for my own writing because I'm working on part three of my own YA sci-fi trilogy, and having gone through quite a bit of that, I have moments in the second one where there are incidents such as that. So I am, like I said, I'm a sucker for that. And the fact that I got to see that moment between Optimus Prime and Megatron when they would normally, like I'm so used to them just basically beating the hell out of each other if they were that close the way they were in the movie. So the fact that they actually had a real legit conversation, I thought was wonderful.
We tried really hard. First of all, thank you for all that. I appreciate you saying all that. Second part of that is we tried, especially in Siege, again, this goes back to what I was talking about with the being making a show that was sort of not a brick wall for newcomers.
Yeah.
So especially in Siege, I'm sort of backtracking to get to the scene you're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Is we have that conflict very early on, that sort of fist fight between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
When he goes to rescue B and Wheeljack Optimus in the thing, And one of the reasons why we did that, well, there's several reasons we did that. One was we wanted to clearly, especially for newcomers or anybody watching the shows, clearly establish the conflict between the two of them and what the sort of, A, what the stakes are, B, what their personal relationship was. And we sneak a lot in there about Alpha Trion, about them being the students of Alpha Trion and all this stuff and how to do that. And it was also to show at that point, Megatron was physically the dominant alpha in their relationship.
Yeah.
Because in our sort of minds, if it wasn't for this ideological split and Megatron's sort of greed or, you know, desire for power and inability to be flexible for what he thinks is best for Cybertron, he might have been the leader. He might have, like, and even Optimus at a certain point acknowledges that.
Yeah.
So subsequently, when you get to the second one in that scene you're talking about, which I'm a big fan of that scene also, and I believe Tim Sheridan wrote that scene, and it's a great scene.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Tim, for doing that, because it's real. It really was terrific.
It's a bit where we expand on it a little bit, that what that relationship is even at this point, now that all the sort of all this awful stuff has happened between the two of them and they're trying to save the planet and all this stuff, but it's still intentionally intimate. And in a lot of ways, and I feel like people don't quite get this at times with the show, it was to show just how, in a lot of ways, Optimus and Megatron are very similar. They're two sides of a coin. And because we didn't want it to be mustache twirly, you know, that what you were referencing in the old episodes in More Than Meets the Eye, where it's like, I want power and I want blah, blah, blah. In his mind, Megatron in particular, this is what's best for his people.
Yeah.
And Prime can't understand that from the point of view of violent means or extreme measures kind of thing.
Right.
And that's why he says in the beginning of the first season, we're not the Decepticons when they let B go.
Right.
He knows if that was with the Decepticons, B would be locked up or worse. And so we were fortunate, and Hasbro knew we were going to do this and they were on board with all this, sort of trying to, when the moments presented themselves, dive into the intricacies of their relationship and who they are as people. And I think it's tricky with Optimus because he's so stoic. It's almost like Superman to a degree. It's like, what can you do with him?
Yeah.
I mean, so like, especially when Megatron refers to Alita as Ariel, she's dead and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And he's still trying to mess with Optimus. He's still trying to goad him. Like, he still knows how to push the buttons. And Optimus, at this point, these guys are relatively young. I want to say young in comparison to what we know them as.
Right.
Right. So they still have that ability to get it under each other's skin. And it almost pains Megatron that Prime's the one who's going to rescue him. Because that's sort of like when he turns on him later.
Yeah.
Like, Megatron just knows how to be a manipulative dude.
Yeah.
So again, I appreciate you acknowledging that scene, because you're probably the first to really bring that up in any significant way. Yeah, because the thing with these shows is, and I'm going to sound like a bit of an asshole. Sorry if I can't curse on this.
It's all right. I'll just slap an E on it. No worries.
Okay. The thing is, when you talk about the voices and things like that, which we've gotten a lot of flack for, and I acknowledge that.
Right.
And I'm saying this as somebody literally who has Star Wars on in the background on the TV and all this stuff, and is a DC Comics fan and a Star Wars fan and Transformers fan and all this stuff. I've gotten to a point personally where, like, if I don't like something, like, I don't like the Zack Snyder DC movies, right?
Right.
I'm not going to go online and shit talk them or whatever. I'm just, they're always going to make more and something will eventually click.
Right.
I mean, like, and I do like anybody who tries something new with something like JJ with Star Trek and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And but the problem is now these franchises, and you and I are men of a certain age. I'm only a couple years older than you. That the problem is we're the first sort of generation of legitimate, like, fandom, right?
Yeah.
And now we're into like 2, 3, 4 generations of fandom since, in particular, the 70s, the 60s, 70s into the 80s is where it really kicks off.
Yeah.
And the problem is, like anything in life, you always remember your first love, right? Or you remember when you first fell in love with something. And the problem becomes that there's an, with that comes an expectation when these things come out.
Yeah.
Right. Like there's an expectation of, and you're subsequently judged, not always on the work. And I'm not saying this applies to everybody, not always on the work, but what person, what somebody's romantic vision of such and such franchise should be.
Mm-hmm.
Versus it's more about what it should be versus what it actually is, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, we all have our, like our thoughts like back then about like what it should be and falling in love with that and everything as we saw it then. But then as time goes on, it's like we have our own interpretation of what they were and how they made us feel, which is why like there are a lot of things that when we revisit them years later, it's like, I don't remember it being like that. And then all of a sudden, like the bloom is off the rose. Now all of a sudden it was just like something that you watched religiously when you were a kid. You can't bring yourself to watch now.
Well, that's how I was with the Adam West Batman, right?
Yeah. So,
which when we were kids were on in reruns.
Right.
Because it was before our time, right? But the
89 movie kind of spoiled that.
No, but I'm even talking before that. Like, so yeah. The 89 movie is one of those things that really holds up. And then, but I remember, I mean, I'm talking 3-4 years old, mm-hmm. being scared out of my mind by Cesar Romero.
Yeah.
Right. Like mm-hmm. really like the Joker scared the living hell out of me. And then I remember being 6 or 7 years old and being like, exactly like you said, what was that about?
Yeah.
Why was I scared of that guy?
Mm-hmm.
And then again, being the right age for Dark Knight Returns and mm-hmm. Watchmen and all these things that sort of comics at a certain point sort of grew up alongside our age group in particular.
Yeah.
And so by the time you get to the 89 Batman and you're a teenager and it's the coolest thing you've ever seen, right?
Because your sensibilities are all like dialed in at the right time. Yeah.
Right. And I'm sorry.
Oh, I was saying like it's I saw recently the reissued Masters of the Universe figures that were done like in the early 2000s or so. I think it was either Four Horsemen or Super Seven or something like that redid them. But what they did was they took the old versions from the early 80s and then they made them larger. They made them more detailed. They made them more articulate. And it was basically just like, this is how we thought they would be back then. So it's kind of like it's almost catching us up to those sensibilities. So seeing something like this, I thought was very refreshing because it didn't feel like it had enough of Generation One, but it didn't try to emulate it so much and be a slave to it.
I appreciate that. Like, and that was intentional. It's when you talk about Masters of the Universe, what they did with the current show was the intention of, hey, we're going to continue on where it left off.
Right.
And we weren't going to do that with this, meaning mm-hmm. obviously we get a glimpse of what the toy line is going to be and what the packaging is going to be and what the tone and the thing. And a lot of that is based on Hasbro studying who their buying audience is. Yeah. So I'm creating a show for the widest possible audience for Transformers. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily commercial for toys, but I was trying to always approach it. The writers were always trying to approach it as being a fan-friendly show in terms of respecting the toys. Maybe I was naive about this, George, to begin with, in that we used, I've said this plenty of times before, but we used the digital data, the CAD data of the toys to create our models,
mm-hmm.
especially in Siege and Earthrise.
Yeah.
So the idea was, hey, they would be toy accurate and the transformations where we could afford it and do it, especially the main characters, Optimus, Megatron, etc., would be like when you see them transform on screen, that's actually accurate to the toy.
Yeah.
And I thought in my mind, that was a selling point, right? Mm-hmm. But then you have a subsection of the audience going, well, I can see all the toy marks. I can see the holes and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, what's that fine line between creating the entertainment and satisfying the fan?
Right.
And I feel to the credit of everybody involved with it, we sort of successfully walked that line because I think we helped drum up interest in the toys. Hasbro, for a fact, has told me that the toys have taken a significant bump because of the show, mm-hmm. which is very refreshing. And the show has done very well viewer-wise, especially with the diehard audiences and families, which was a big surprise because we were trying to do something that skewed a little older, but we found out more families were watching with their kids. And I think that has to do with, again, going back sound like a bunch of boomers, but guys our age who have kids now,
yeah,
wanting to share that experience.
Yep.
Of Transformers. And
I do that with my daughter. My daughter's 3 years old, and I got her the Bumblebee and Optimus from the Rescue Bots Academy line. So she has her own, and then I have my own. And then she'll want to watch. She actually likes watching a lot of the G1 episodes. I think she can just like identify them a lot the easiest. But we'd be watching War for Cybertron, and she would point at the screen and say, like, is that Megatron? And I was like, yes, very good. So it was good. It was refreshing to see that. It was good to know that she's getting into it just like I am. Just like I've always.
So what you're saying is that she's going to host the 10th anniversary podcast when I come back.
Basically, yeah. There you go. So yeah, and also speaking of Wheeljack and Bumblebee, good call putting them in the first scene together.
That was a tribute. George Christick, who's one of the producers and came up with the story with me.
Yeah,
he came up with that idea. He wrote that episode, and
that was so smart.
Idea was, how do we do? I'm sure I get my. There's always those fans who are going to abuse me and send me nasty messages and stuff like that. But the show was definitely intended to be a love letter to the franchise as a whole,
mm-hmm.
sort of focused first on G1.
Yeah.
And starting at that point, at least in my mind, was when George came up with it, was this is something to honor what's come before. This is something to say, this is what we love and this is what we respect.
Yeah.
Hope that all makes sense.
It does. Yeah. And it's tributes like that, that are unexpected and happily welcomed. Like I wouldn't have thought that if to have the first scene feature Wheeljack and Bumblebee, but it's brilliant. It was a great means of reminding people just like, oh yeah, those are the first two Autobots Transformers in general that we saw in More Than Meets the Eye Part One, and all the other sort of name droppings like Ariel and Orion and all that sort of stuff was just really, it took me back. It reminded me that this is a franchise that's worth continuing on. And as long as you can, as long as you look at those Generation One shows, the movie, even the Marvel comics, that provides a wonderful template and you can just go wherever you like from there. But having those little nods, that's a great way to look at, to acknowledge the fans with that.
Oh, good. I'm glad you caught that.
Yeah. So FJ, I have to ask, when all this was, when you were working on this, since we're talking about G1, were there any talents from G1 that stopped in and kind of gave their feedback about what was going on?
Yeah, well, we got very, very lucky in that sort of, in the process, I got to reconnect. I had known him years before, but with Flint Dilley, who I know you've had on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you had him on twice. Flint, he's a prince of a man. So.
Yes, he's wonderful. In fact, his book is right here.
Oh, and, I love the book, yeah.
Yeah, it's so good. And Flint was really supportive. We had him, this is literally just before COVID.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And he came to the office and we screened the first episode for him.
Yeah.
And he was so supportive and so nice about it.
Mm-hmm.
In that, and he would tell us how, he would tell us these great stories where it was basically like, I think the exact quote he said to me was, I feel sorry for you guys.
Mm.
And I said, why? He goes, because when we did the original shows, we thought they would air twice and never be seen again. There was no VHS. There was no home video yet.
Yeah.
There was blah, blah, blah. He goes, we didn't think about things like continuity
mm-hmm.
or legacy or whatever.
Yeah.
And even when we did the 86 movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, I didn't realize till years later. And I started working with people who had sort of were in the industry because of things like this, that how much it means to people.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, so it's like, he's a guy who understands and appreciates the fans of it. You know what I mean? Like he sat there and he was so good about how to, he basically said to me, like, don't sweat it at a certain point. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, just, you know, tell your story.
Encouraging emails like, you make your show, don't worry about it.
Right. Yeah. Because, I mean, really, if people want that show, then they're more than welcome to check it out on Tubi. They have it there for free. And if they want something that takes those characters in some new and really interesting directions, I would wholeheartedly recommend this to them.
Yeah. And it's, I respected it because, like I was saying before, I want new.
Yeah.
I mean, like, but I mean, I'm one of those guys, like, I don't need to go back, like the Master of the Universe thing, like the continuation of the series. Like, I don't get that personally,
right?
As a fan. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't need the continuation of, like, hey, this picks up 5 minutes later. Like, right. I'm okay with Star Wars. Like, oh, we'll do prequels and sequels and stuff. Like, it's fine, mm-hmm. as long as it's good and interesting and all that stuff.
Right.
With this, to me, it was, we had the inherent thing, especially now that all three seasons are out, is the understanding that by the Beast, and I told Hasbro this at a certain point, is by having the Beast Wars characters in this, you inherently contradict G1 and Beast Wars.
Mm.
So by its nature, it's new. And from this idea came the idea that we sort of set up in this, which is there's a Transformers multiverse.
Yeah.
And some of this had to do with the fact that early on Hasbro said that they were trying to, like, when I, to give you context, I'm talking really out of school, is when I started working with Hasbro on Power of the Primes, which I was not the showrunner of, just a writer.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you'd sit there and say, well, what is your current version of Megatron? They'd be like, whatever you want. Whatever you want to do. Like, they were super supportive.
Wow.
But they had no sort of, like, they spent the last couple of years sort of developing the brand internally, which is sort of what Siege in particular is the launching point of the aligned continuity along with Cyberverse, right? So the idea was, if a significant historical thing happened in the show, like Optimus throwing the Allspark into the space bridge,
mm-hmm.
and because Cyberverse touches on that, we touch on it, it's told differently, but it's still the same thing.
Yeah.
So by the time we got to Siege, after doing the third one of Power of the Primes, they had these brand decks and these, like, beautiful, like, 400 or 500 page documents of who these characters are and all that stuff that you give to writers, and like, and you just want to, as a fan, want to being having access to this is amazing.
Yeah.
So we didn't want to retread what had existed already. We wanted to, sure, when it first came out, we said it's a prequel to G1, and technically the story is, but where it goes, especially when they enter the dead universe and the whole galaxy sort of changes.
Yeah.
The idea was to open up all these new possibilities that you could do anything with these guys.
And yeah, it definitely shows. And I, like I said, I was really taken by it. I would recommend any other fan, definitely give it a look. I'm glad to hear that Flint gave his blessing with it. And I'm hoping that goodwill continues on. Now, I do have to ask really quickly, do you have a chapter 2 set in mind for everything here from this trilogy, considering the way that there are quite a few threats that are still out there? Do you have something in mind, or is it something where you've gotten this far and you're just going to, like, leave it alone for now? And if an opportunity comes later, then you have the means to pick it up.
The only answer I can give you to that, George, is a little bit of both.
Hmm. Yeah.
Meaning, yes, there are ideas where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we will wait to see
if it's called. If you're called upon.
The call and do it,
yeah.
We're prepared. We might not get the call. We might get the call. It's just, that's how it is.
Yeah. I know how that is. Like, I have my 5-part sci-fi trilogy that's out there right now. It's in, you know, book form and everything. And I have an idea for a sequel, but I know that the only way that I'm going to explore that is if there is enough, if there's enough demand for it. So like that's something that I'll just kind of keep in the back of my mind, but at the same time, I'm not ready to bring it out and start exploring it because I haven't gotten any call for it. So I'll just leave it alone for the time being. But so one thing I definitely have asked all my guests before, FJ, what would you say? It's been 3.5 decades now since Transformers the movie has come out. Granted, we didn't touch on it all that much here, but at the same time, we've done quite a bit of talking about it during this whole month. And I'm curious to get your take on this. What would you say it is about this movie? It's been 3.5 decades. Hasbro is all in celebrating its 35th anniversary. They have the Studio Series 86 line, which looks fabulous. And there's so much goodwill surrounding this. Another re-release of the movie itself, now on 4K. And everything that's gone on like recently, it just feels like there's one big continuing love fest for this movie that's not going to go away anytime soon. What would you say, what would you say is the legacy of this movie?
That's a question that can be answered on so many different levels. It has the nature of never having been done before at the time.
It's ballsy.
Something at this scope, meaning just on paper, the idea of like, hey, we're going to do a giant animated movie with actors, famous actors doing the voices. Like no one had done that kind of stuff before.
Yeah.
Right. And again, they were all in those days, and even Flint will sort of tell us this, they were commercials for toys, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, but then when you go beyond the audacity of doing it, which is amazing, mm-hmm. right? The second part is the movie is literally insane.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Structure, I'm talking from a structural point of view, a storytelling point of view, it's nuts. Mm-hmm. And I think the other big thing is, especially in a non-internet age where you went into things cold and not knowing what was going to happen, mm-hmm. is the sheer audacity. That's the word I keep going back to.
Yeah.
Of killing Prime and reformatting Megatron, mm-hmm. which in our more cynical years, we know there were business toy reasons for this kind of thing.
Right. But they could have gone like the full on cynical route and like stuck all the 84 guys onto a ship and then thrown it into the sun. And then it would just be like, oh, they're gone. All right, let's go ahead and focus on these guys now. That would have been just pure cynical and like fans would have seen right through that. But thankfully they didn't do that. Right. And granted they gave, and this was from my talk with both Ron Friedman and Flint. They were given the directive from Hasbro to kill these characters, not just write them out or put them over, you know, here while the new characters are taking center stage. They wanted them dead. Like they would have sent a Hasbro rep over to your toy box, picked up your Ironhide, broken it in half, and then say, here, now buy Ultra Magnus. So, right. but at the same time, like you said, it still shows so much audacity. I always say like, it's ballsy, like from start to finish, they did things that you could not get away with these days.
Oh no, you could never do any of this now. You know what I mean? Like, and that's the beauty when we were sort of talking about before about the era, mm-hmm. is all these things were new and all these things were doing. And to your point, ballsy is the best word for it.
Yeah.
Because I think it's those sort of significant, and it's so tonally all over the place. And I mean that in a affectionate way.
Yeah.
Right. That what happens is everybody who watches it latches onto something in it. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you like the cornier part of it, or if you like the Optimus dying part of it, or the Unicron part of it. Like it's just this amazing sort of concoction of all these cool elements of the actual premise of robots that transform, and subsequently it's also, by the way, from a technical level, it's so miles ahead of the TV series.
Oh yeah.
And that was a big thing for me, was the quality of it. Mm-hmm. The Japanese anime feel of it really stuck with me in particular.
Yeah.
And and some of those set pieces, you know, especially the converting Megatron to Galvatron. It's, mm-hmm. it's so wild and so wonderful and had never been done before. And that had a big impact on the show, especially with the way we use Galvatron. And we sort of applied a lot of that logic to Nemesis Prime.
Yeah.
And Unicron, which when we originally wrote it, Unicron was just going to be a voice kind of thing. But then mm-hmm. we found out long before anybody knew about it, that Hasbro was going to do this giant Unicron toy. And we were able to use the assets from that.
Which is insane. It was just like, I looked at that. I was just like, there's no way I can possibly own this now. But that would definitely be like a bucket list thing to own. It looks fabulous. I love
it. I have no place to put it. That's the real problem. There's literally no place to put it. So yeah. It's like, I didn't even ask. I always have to ask the toys. Like, I always have to be like, guys, can I have this? But like, that I was just like, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do with this thing. Right. Like, I don't know where we're going to put this. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't even have fit in the office. You know, but it's so gorgeous. And, mm-hmm. and as much as we wanted to do stuff like that, we also wanted to do things that were new in it or brought new things to it. Like how to take Alita One and make her a significant character. And my favorite thing was our ability to introduce the mercenary faction into it, do something new, or the Ark turning into the bot at the end. You know, these were things that we felt very fortunate and privileged to be able to introduce into the franchise for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what would you say your final thoughts are on this trilogy now that it's out? It's been out just a few weeks at this point. So you're pretty fresh on everything. So when you look back at it, this trilogy, which was, I would definitely say, is a high mark of this franchise. And it's gone through like a lot of different ebbs and flows, but this one's a definite like must watch, I would say, like for that I would say to any fan.
Well, thank you, first off. That's the first thing. So the thing is, and I'm just being honest with you, is I'm so close to it mm-hmm. that what I can say is I'm super proud of it.
Yeah.
And I'm super proud of the work everybody worked on it, put into it, because I've been around a little bit in this industry, and I've never been involved with a project where everybody involved was aligned in what this should be and how to do it. So, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of it being a very, very smooth experience with the occasional speed bumps that all productions have.
Right.
But what I do know is 5, 10, 20 years from now, it's something I'll remain incredibly proud of in order to have had the privilege of being someone who gets to contribute in the sort of rarefied air of the people you've been talking to.
Yeah.
To contribute in a significant way to this franchise.
Oh yeah. And that is definitely a mission accomplished there.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, FJ DeSanto, for being a part of this show and this miniseries. We're going to get right back in with the returning Flint Dilley to talk about everything that happened on the show right after Transformers the movie. But first, a quick word about the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp. Founded in 1988 by Paul Newman, the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp provides a different kind of healing to more than 20,000 seriously ill children and family members annually, all completely free of charge. For many of these children and families, Hole in the Wall provides multiple camp experiences throughout the year at the facility in Ashford, Connecticut, in more than 40 hospitals and clinics, directly in camper homes and communities, and through other outreach activities across the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic. I'm going to have this link available so you can go ahead and click on the button there and donate just as I am this month. All you have to do is go to holeinthewallgang.org. Thank you very much, and without further ado, let's go to the second half of this episode. So, Flint, you were also responsible for a lot that came into season 3 that picked up basically right where the movie left off. And you're also introducing all these new characters to a lot of people that really had not seen the movie. So you were given a really interesting task to start up this whole new season, introduce all these new characters with vague references to the movie, so that way they still have something to kind of go back on.
Right.
So what was it like getting the opportunity to do what I consider one of the finest stories in all of Transformers, which was Five Faces of Darkness?
Well, yeah, Five Faces of Darkness was an interesting one because, yeah, we were trying to figure out, yeah, as you pointed out, and you're right, we realized we were picking up from the end of the last season. We realized that the series had fundamentally transformed. It's you know, pardon the pun. It was now 20 years later. We didn't really account, nor did anybody give a lot of thought to how you would account for the in between mm-hmm. years. Because what's funny is the movie, it doesn't feel that yeah. unnatural. So we didn't really address mm-hmm. that issue. And it worked out pretty well. But there is this nice hole you can yeah. have fun with. The problem is that, you know, when it all leads to the movie, it takes a little of the mystery out of mm-hmm. the story, right? And so yeah, figure out how to do it. But what I thought was really good was, yeah, we it was a very conscious decision to start it 20 years after and to keep yeah. rolling with it that way. And so Five Faces of Darkness was the actual toys themselves, which remember they're leading the charge yeah. on this. The actual toys themselves in season three were very science fictiny looking oh, yeah. toys. The toys didn't look anymore like there was something right. on Earth, you know. And so then it was the fun became, okay, you're in the aftermath of this war. And the movie introduced all sorts of, and there, that's not to say that none of this was ever mm-hmm. in the series, just all sorts of planets we'd never seen before, all sorts of races of people we'd never yep. seen before. And so it went from being a Earth-based Transformer show to a space-based Transformer yeah. show, right?
And it was a blast to see, too.
And yeah, and that exact moment I was you know, working on like Dungeons and Dragons things. So I thought, oh, let's bring some of that mm-hmm. into Transformers. Yeah. And we did. All of a sudden you had strange aliens that looked like, I don't know that they looked like dragons, but they looked yeah. like something. And you have Skuxoids, you have sort of funny aliens,
oh, yeah.
you have all sorts of ridiculous characters running around. And we had mm-hmm. fun doing that. And you start having, you know, extragalactic Olympics and then the entire series, then there was this kind of, and I don't know, you know, whether this is just my inner darkness or why it happened, but a lot of things took on a kind of darker, more morbid tone than they previously
yeah had. I would say that,
and
I would say that, but at the same time, like, this is my third year associated with the project. I've gone from with all this, like, I started watching it in third grade and then fourth grade, now here I am in fifth grade. Like, I'm getting older, so it seems like the show itself yeah. is getting older with me, which I appreciate.
Well, that was another thing. Actually, I've never really talked about this before, but that was another thing we didn't know, is we didn't know whether the audience would get older. We would sort of advance in our thinking yeah. about this stuff. And what we didn't know is whether the audience mm-hmm. would too, which was just kind of an interesting question. And so we tended to do older mm-hmm. things in the third season, and the audience seemed to kind of yeah. ride with it. And also, yeah, shortly after we started, probably like right after I wrote Five Faces mm-hmm. of Darkness, then, you know, we got the bad call that Hasbro was upset, because the story then was that a kid had locked himself into his basement and hadn't come out for a week. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I believe this. I didn't right. have kids then. I mean, now as a parent, what I know is our kids could have locked themselves locked themselves in the bathroom. And didn't come out for a week. That we believed that story. Okay. And as a parent now, I know that my kids would have been able to lock themselves in the bathroom for about 3 minutes and that probably yeah. would have been solved. But I was totally buying into, oh, some kid locked himself into the bathroom for a week. And that's because we killed Optimus Prime and it ruined his life. And we right. felt bad about that. And Hasbro felt bad about that, and so they you know just wanted a fix. You know, there was just
Dark Awakening was already in the pipeline at that point, right?
Well, Dark Awakening was exactly was in the pipeline, and nobody had the heart to tell Hasbro, "Oh yeah, we did another episode where Optimus Prime comes back as a zombie and we kill him again." That would not have been a good career move. And so we just kind of, you know,
that was such a great episode, though. It was that it packed such a great punch.
Yeah, you know, that was like, and I think, I mean, I'm not sure who's credited with writing it.
Anthony Zalewski. Yeah.
I mean, I think of it as Steve Gerber because I remember him pitching that idea. I'm sure Anthony's.
I can see Steve doing that.
No, it was just pure Gerber, and I mean, it's possible that he didn't write it, but he was just highly amused by the fact we're going to kill him again, and or that we had it in the process, and I think Steve might have been editing at that point. It's because I was still running Transformers, but I was on doing Inhumanoids and Visionaries, and I think starting Visionaries and stuff like that. And so that I was otherwise occupied by that point. But that was Dark Awakening is one of my favorites. Yeah. It's one of those things where you just, there's just something kind of, there's something cool about it.
Yeah, it's.
And Starscream's Ghost is one other one. We were just going all sorts of, because I would personally was probably about as bummed out about killing Starscream as Optimus Prime.
He was such a great character.
Yeah, that's probably. You know, he's a great character, and he was always one of my favorite Transformers, and so I wanted to bring him back in some form, and a lot of these characters came back. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ultra Magnus comes back without explanation,
right?
Because it just nobody really wanted to see Ultra Magnus dead. Yeah, that's the really interesting thing about it is that the third season for a variety. I mean, at a sheer production behind the veil, a sheer production issue. We knew that was probably the last hurrah. And so, they ordered very few shows. They really just wanted Optimus Prime back. Yeah, I'll never know how much that was because Hasbro was basically unhappy about the fact that we killed them and how much it was they had enough episodes for a package, for a syndication package, so they didn't need any more. I don't know what the really real... Yeah. But that's
and I just wish like as a fan, as someone who's, you know, been steeped in all of this for over 35 years, I just wish that that whoever had put together the two-parter Return of Optimus Prime had it start off after Prime ship blew up and just had him just like floating out there. And so then they could say like, hey, what's that? That's right there. And they can see his banged up body and everything instead of just sitting on a ship completely pristine condition.
Yeah, I think at that moment the issue was not how elegant are we going to be about this, let's just stop the bleeding. But that would have been a cool
everything else. I mean, like the look of that, of those episodes, it was the best looking animation since the movie. Like that was something that just the look of that movie was spectacular.
Oh, that's funny because the animation on that is frequently a controversial topic, and a lot of people thought that season three looked bad. Yeah, and there is a faction. I mean, it's really funny. There is a faction of people who think exactly what you think, and they think it's really Five Faces of Darkness. And what's really funny is that I particularly like that. Not just because I wrote it, but. What I liked that we did in that was that we were sort of setting up the franchise for what could the franchise be sort of forever. What I mean, and what could we do? What could we do with it? And Five Faces of Darkness really, I kind of felt when I got done with that, okay, the franchise is in good hands, and Godspeed.
Yeah. Yep.
What I mean, and then season three was really just kind of a smorgasbord of possibilities for what could happen.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Flynn Dilley. Thank you so much, FJ DeSanto. What a terrific part four this was for the Transformers the Movie 35th Anniversary Celebration. Next week, we're finishing it all off with part five, talking about the legacy of Transformers the Movie. We're not only going to hear from returning guests giving their final thoughts, but we're also going to be hearing a lot from two different designers from Hasbro talking about the Transformers Studio Series and everything else that they have been working on, plus everything that inspired them to join Hasbro in the first place. We are ending this miniseries in the best possible way. I am so excited, and I'm so thrilled that all of you have been able to listen. I hope that all of you have been able to give to the Hole in the Wall Gang camp, and I really hope that all of you come back for part five in this great miniseries. Until then, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, till all are one, and ever upward. Thank you for listening to the Excelsior Journeys miniseries celebrating the 35th anniversary of Transformers the Movie. Thank you for donating to the Hole in the Wall Gang camp. Thank you, Zach Comtois, for providing the intro and outro to this miniseries. For more information about Excelsior Journeys, please go to he'sgotit.com/podcasts.